So from summing up on this particular point about observing a root with what other experts have said, it's a mycorrhiza fungi attached to it. Really, a farmer has got to take a soil sample and have it tested by a laboratory who can test for fungi and bacteria. And going back to the proportions you talked about a few minutes ago.
To get a definitive answer, that's what they would need to do. But if their plants are healthy and they're able to deal with and tolerate the weather extremes and the disease pressures that are normally there, and they've got a farming system there, then it's an academic position to be saying, oh, well, we need to find out if it's mycorrhizal or not. If you're, in fact, in a position of decline, that you're not sure what is happening in the soil, and you want to get some answers, so you know what risks you may need to deliver to the plant or to the soil, then examination under the microscope is almost mandatory if you want to bring the microbiology into play. What is important is the overall management of the growing system as well, and in a situation where you're trying to grow crops or you're trying to maintain a pasture cover for grazing purposes and also to protect the soil so it doesn't get flooded away, washed away or blown away in the case of dry. And we've had both extremes now in Australia over the last few years where, you know, even just recently we've had some significant rains here in my district in Gippsland, and just this last week some major landslips have occurred that have, you know, cut off half a dozen roads through the Strzelecki's, and a lot of landholders going, whoa, we've lost hundreds of acres probably of land, and dams have gone as well. It's simply that we haven't recognised that our treatment of the land and also the steepness of the land has not factored in the need to maintain a good biological presence in that soil to allow it to be held in place. You know, a good, highly fungal soil will have the mechanical strength to hold in place a lot more than one that doesn't, and that's quite often overlooked as well. But if we go back to the first part of what we're talking about there about maintaining growth all year round, mycorrhiza fungi, importantly, require active plant root and live plant and plant root to be able to attach to and derive its energy from. It will sporulate, and therefore, in the case of some annual plants, the sporulation is important. But with perennial plants, it needs to attach itself to them, and some spores will be formed in case the plant dies off due to drought or flood. And so when the conditions are right and soil again, and you've got new live plants coming through and new roots being formed, that the spores will attach themselves. Otherwise, we need to inoculate with mycorrhiza as well. And therefore, our farming system, our farming management is so vitally important. And things like methods like column sizes, pasture cropping are so important that you're always maintaining a pasture and then putting a crop through into that using special equipment and managing it so that you've got summer active grasses and winter active grain crops, cereal crops coming through and getting the benefit of being able to crop it, but not risking the soil to flood or drought. So it's fairly important that we recognise that there's a lot of latitude in the way we manage things, but when we push it to the extreme, we could lose the land quite simply, like the landslips that have occurred here just recently.
So I guess monoculture, which quite often just nukes the growth in the summer months, is not good for mycorrhiza fungi. Having a growth of good quality growth, meaning growth that harbours mycorrhiza fungi through the summer months, is really the go.
Well, any form of monoculture any form of monoculture is not a natural form. So wherever it's physically possible and possible from the point of view of the market, we're much better off to have integrated and interplanting of different plants to enable that diversity to be held in the soil as well. But obviously that's not practical from the point of view of the grains that we need for our breads and so on, the very basic staple diet. But at the same time, interplanting of shelter belts is so critical to any of the work we do, and unfortunately in this country we still haven't developed that thinking far enough yet. Shelter belts are vitally important to help keep the soil there and create small eco pockets or microclimates that will actually benefit the soil, the plants, and any animals we choose to have as part of our farm mix. And as we know, if we've got diversity in numbers, even in our communities, if we have different people with different strengths, then we're going to have a much stronger community. But if we're all the same, we've all been trained as say scientists, and that's all we do, then obviously there's not going to be much depth to our ability to sustain a community. So the same thing applies in our ecosystems as well, and our ecosystems are extended to our agricultural systems.
Yeah. So we mentioned Colin Sice and the pasture cropping with the grasses growing, virtually grass growing right throughout the year. So yeah. It's a pretty tough mindset change for farmers who have been taught for now 50-odd years to spray out their summer grasses because of various reasons. They in actual fact setting a situation up which is adverse to growing their winter crop, really.
And they most certainly are, because not only, I mean, seeing is believing. If they saw that they needed these mycorrhiza fungi, and it's been proven with quite a bit of mainstream research now as well, that a lot of the croppers over the last few years have decided to look at alternative ways of getting phosphorus to their plants rather than applying phosphatic fertilizers. There's been a very big push towards mycorrhiza fungi because they have, mycorrhiza fungi have the ability to extract that phosphorus out of the soil. So it is important that we recognise that it's got that quality about it as well. Not all plants are mycorrhizal, of course, and we need to be aware of that too. Some select, like the brassicas, that are not. But the thing that is very important is we need to look at the history of our farming system and the way we've treated our soils and look at the toxins that we've actually applied to it and how much cultivation we've performed, because too much of our agricultural land is devoid or very low in fungal numbers. It's only when it's left to rest in a soil-covered situation with any sort of plant that you actually start getting some recovery of the soil food web in the balance that's required for that plant that's growing there at the time. But as we discussed before, give the soil a bit more rest and give the pasture a bit more rest, and you'll find it'll actually go towards woody weeds. And the reason for that is nature saying, well, let's increase the solar panels some more and put weeds there that have the ability to have a larger surface area than just a flat surface on the soil, and that therefore we're going to be able to entrain or capture, sequester more carbon and more energy back into the soil again and help build that soil up and make it more stable again for any adverse conditions that might arise. So in our agricultural system, over-cultivation, over-spraying and over-fertilising have actually killed off a lot of those very organisms that we need to maintain our production and maintain our soil health and function.
Gerhard, I want to emphasise that particular point that you brought up, because various scientific experts have said that whether it's a fungicide applied to a crop above the ground or whether it's an insecticide applied to get rid of insects above the ground, that those insecticides actually double up as a fungicide. So you've got these fungicides and insecticides getting into the soil. So what sort of effect have the insecticides and fungicides, well, let's just talk about fungicides, have on the soils, fungi in the soil, which are incredibly important, as we've just been discussing?
Well, even the common lime sulfurs and copper sulfates that have been used by the nature of what they've been asked to perform in the context of dealing with disease, bacterial or fungal diseases on the plants, will, as those residues accumulate in the soil, will have a toxic effect on the microbial life that's there as well. You'll find that I think the European community in the organic circles at least have stipulated there's not to be any more copper sulfate to be used. Now, it's been used for hundreds of years, but the accumulated effect is such that it's actually killing off the soils, and particularly the fungi in the soil as well. What needs to be done is that we need to address that situation and then look for more natural approaches. And obviously the biological approach is one that has got huge potential. We still don't know anywhere near enough to get the maximum value from it yet. But we can begin to exploit that or employ that a bit more by performing more research and getting some alliances taking place that take us away from the chemical applications. Unfortunately, a lot of the big chemical companies are probably not too keen on that idea because their whole business has been based on that. But hopefully they'll see the merit in looking at the biological approach and start developing a strategy in that direction as well.
Gerard, you mentioned sulfates, which Dr. Elaine Ingham mentions too, or not mentions, she discusses that at length. Like gypsum's got sulfur, and she sees that sulfur as a chemical is very antifungal, and as we've been discussing now, how important fungi is. Now, you mentioned copper sulfate, and there's probably like zinc sulfate. If some soils are very low in copper, so the normal way of putting out copper is copper sulfate, so is that something the farmers should be wary of, that they don't go putting out too much of the sulfate product?
Well, most definitely, and there are limits to what you can put out in any single application, that so you don't have a phytotoxic and then a subsequent soil toxic effect. But ideally what you would do is you would apply the trace elements in the form of the compost, and if the compost feedstocks themselves don't supply enough of those specific traces that have been identified as being deficient, then what you would do is you would actually put those minerals in a form that that can be added to the compost and allow the composting to take place and naturally chelate those minerals and bind them into a colloid as well, so that the plant has easy access to it and that they're also very stable.
That's an interesting thing, Gerhard. We just recently filmed a compost operation, and I won't mention names at this stage, but they are assessing, or I don't know if they're assessing or they've proven that they can use one-tenth of the added inorganic fertilizers to the compost and have the same effect as putting, 90% extra. So is that something what you're trying to intimate with this copper sulfate and that sort of thing putting into the compost? Is that what you're trying to intimate?
Yeah, most definitely. The efficiency, the uptake of those minerals is much, much greater once the biology's had the
They don't need volume.
Definitely don't need the same volumes that we would in the traditional chemical sense. Yeah.
Right.